This is the Christmas show. We are telling people that it's time to donate. The many places that accept food baskets, Christmas gifts, toys. The best place you can call is 210 Napier Street. The phone number there is 528-8073. That's the Christmas store. If you call them and ask them what they need, they will tell you, and then you can drop off exactly what somebody could use. On YouTube, there is an ex-steelworker who is now volunteering for the Wesley Urban Ministry. His name is Bill Mahoney. He does poetry. At the end of the show, I'll give out the URL for his contact for YouTube. In studio today, we have two activists. We have Lynn Aquin from Peer to Peer and Campaign for Adequate Welfare and Disability Benefits. And we also have Professor Sally Palmer. Let's start off with Lynn Aquin.
Who have recently started a project just this year called Peer-to-Peer Mentoring, and I'm the coordinator of volunteers for that project. We help people who are on low income, Ontario Works and Ontario Disability Support Program, just find their way through the system, fill out forms that are so complicated, find resources, start the appeal process if they've been cut off their benefits.
I'm actually retired from the School of Social Work at McMaster, but I've been chairing a committee of social workers ever since the Mike Harris days, because we were concerned about all the cuts he made to social services. And as the chair of the Social Action Committee of the Ontario Association of Social Workers in Hamilton, I joined the Campaign for Adequate Welfare and Disability Benefits, which is made up of people, primarily people on social assistance, and we lobby government and try and increase the visibility of poverty in our community.
And it's Christmas time, so we're here today to talk about some of the problems that people are experiencing still, to make people aware of where the problems are, and then near the end of the show we'll talk about where people can drop off food and Christmas toys and clothing and things like that. Lynn, you have a couple of topics that you were speaking to me about earlier. You want to start off?
I will mention about the Christmas hamper program that the city has. Usually the end of November into up until the December 8th, I believe, was the cutoff day, people could register to get a Christmas basket. And then they will pick them up probably the end of next week and into the week before Christmas. The problem with that is that now, since they are doing a Christmas hamper, the food banks are closed to anybody else. So that their policy is that you receive food once a month from the food banks. It's enough to last you a couple of days. And since you're getting a Christmas basket, the food banks are closed to everybody else or for normal food bank operations.
Who makes the decisions? Is it the city or is it the churches themselves or who makes the decisions?
Well, it's not the churches so much. The churches are still giving theirs out. What they only have small amounts. The big food banks like Neighbor to Neighbor and Salvation Army, Good Shepherd, those kinds of food banks, they're closed for December because they're getting the Christmas hampers ready.
Yeah, but the policy that you talked about, whose policy is that?
I don't know. The food banks are kind of run, they get donations from the city, but they run mostly by food share.
Okay, Sally, you have something to add?
Yeah, I have a comment. The food banks really got going in the 90s when Mike Harris's government cut back social assistance by over 20%. And they started out as a stopgap, but they've really become an institution. And our group was shocked to hear that you really have to go through a means test to get food at a food bank. And you, as Lynn said, you're limited to, usually it's once a month that you can go, and you don't dare go back. One of our members works at the Salvation Army Food Bank, and he says they will tell people if supplies are low, they'll say, don't even come in today. Go back and come back later when we have more things, because this is your only once a month time, and you don't want to waste it on low amounts.
In fact, the Salvation Army, which is one of the better ones, you can only come in every 3 months there.
You're kidding.
No.
Okay. I do know that they kind of bounce off each other. And I do know that they, well, the Out of the Cold does as far as that. But that's a different thing. That's the churches organizing together.
They have you on the computer now so that you can only go to one food bank. they have you on register so that you they know if you've gone to another food bank, and they won't give you anything more.
What a system. Okay. Just to be clear now, the Out of the Cold is run by churches. It's a different system. It's giving people a hot meal between 4 and 6 p.m., and they rotate days in churches. That's different than going to food banks and getting something to take home and cook. There is a great shortage, of course, because we have a lot more people unemployed. We have a lot more people not making enough money to make ends meet because they're on EI. Have you seen increases?
Definitely. The Ontario Works caseload has, I think it's gone up by almost 400 cases a month, every month since last September.
Unbelievable.
I think it was even August, September, October, November. I think the only decrease has been just recently they had maybe 300 cases instead of 400 additional new cases.
So the total would be?
It's really huge. They've gone up by more than 10%, I believe,
oh, yes,
in their caseload.
I think the Ontario Works caseload used to be, over a year ago, it was about 10,000, and now it's up to 15,000.
Okay. 20 years ago, the government made a promise about child poverty. Can we address that?
Yes, that was the federal government pushed by groups of anti-poverty activists who said that they would try and solve child poverty by the year 2000. And there's still a group provincially called Campaign 2000 pushing for that. In fact, the levels of child poverty haven't really changed a lot in the last 20 years because of inflation. One example, I can give you social assistance rates best for individuals because those are the ones that I know best. But the person on social assistance in this year is getting exactly the same money amount they got in 1989. Because since then, the NDP raised the rates by 10%. And since the Liberals got in, they have raised them by about 2% a year. It's up to 11% increase. However, Mike Harris took 21% away. So we're still back where we were in 1989. And everyone knows that inflation goes up by between 1% or 2% per year. So it's estimated that we're 35 to 40% behind in the spending value of the money people on social assistance get.
Can you just let the listeners know how much does a person get when they're on OW and how much do they get a month if they're on ODSP? And ODSP is the disability portion of social services.
Yes. Well, the single person gets $572 a month. I think it may have gone up 2% in November, something like $585 now. The single person on ODSP was getting $1,020. And I'm not sure what the 2% means there.
I think it's $1,042 now they get.
Okay. Do you have particular topics that you want to zero in on?
Well, peer-to-peer mentoring. We have clients come in who have various problems with the system. In the summertime, we were mostly seeing housing problems. Now we're mostly seeing just information about all kinds of different programs, things that they can access. But housing is the biggest problem that we have for people. They're inadequately housed, and people are the definition of homelessness is if you pay more than 30% of your income to housing. And so almost all the people we see coming in, I would consider to be homeless because they're paying between 50 and 90% of their income to housing.
So you're saying in your justification of being homeless is that they're paying that much, but they're staying in their home?
Yes. Some of them are able to. It's an interesting phenomenon that we're getting now that some of the people that we have coming in have inherited their homes from their parents because their parents are elderly now and they've died and the people have inherited their homes. Unfortunately, they're on ODSP or Ontario Works, so they can't afford to keep up their homes. Even though they may have been gifted with this wonderful resource, they're not able to stay there because they're not able to keep up the repairs. They don't make enough money to just maintain their homes. I believe Habitat for Humanity has started a new branch of their service that they will actually now help people do that. So we're investigating that for our clients. We've had several clients come in who say they're just not able to stay. They've got this wonderful thing that they've been given, and they can't stay there. They have to get rid of it. In fact, they're losing their homes there. They're not able to even sell them.
Would it be taxes as part of the big reason they're losing their homes?
I believe it's mostly repairs, mostly maintenance. I don't know about the taxes.
And the fuel bills?
There is a person who, they're all over the city. People are inheriting homes that are in good neighborhoods, in wealthy neighborhoods, and certainly they aren't able to afford to keep those homes.
Okay, housing's always been a problem.
It's really bad now because of the low amounts of money that people are given to live on. And the housing standards, you have to be able to understand how things are in a home. We had a client who came, and their landlord told them, I don't have a fridge for you. Too bad you don't get a fridge. So he has to go out and buy food quickly, have it, use it up, and he can't afford to buy a refrigerator. He's on Ontario Works. Also, the places, everybody knows about the bed bug problem in Hamilton. It's really bad. Getting landlords to fumigate, it's very expensive for them, and they keep coming back. So I can understand landlords, but I can understand people can't live in that kind of situation. It's horrible for them.
What are we talking about, apartments or houses?
Apartments, houses, mostly apartments, I'd say.
Okay, Sally?
Yes, this is related to the housing situation, and it's about utilities and heat. At the Campaign for Adequate Welfare, we heard from one of Lynn's volunteers, Barbara LaFleche, about a case of that I think is unfortunately becoming more common. And Lynn can correct me if I'm wrong on the details, but this family is living in Hamilton housing. That's public housing. And for some reason, the public housing was set up with electric heat, which is extremely expensive. And they got way behind on paying their heat and were having it shut off. And they appealed to the city to help them out with it. And the result was that the city, a high-ranking social services official at the city, telephoned the Children's Aid Society saying that these children might need to be rescued from the family. And this put the children into a state of terror and certainly did nothing to help the family. I'm not sure how it's been evolved, but
I remember I wrote something about that in the Spectator on a call, and I never did find out the result of that. But that happens quite a bit.
Unfortunately, because of the electric heat in the geared-to-income housing, it doesn't matter if the rent is low. You can't afford to pay for the heat. It's gigantic bills, $500 a month. And then the hydro is on top of that. So even though people have a place to live, they can't afford to stay there.
Any other problems you want to zero in on?
Well, I'd like to go back to the child poverty issue, because one of the ways the federal government did respond to the child poverty issue was by beginning to give a supplement. There's a national child benefit, national child tax benefit given to everyone, and sort of takes the place of the old family allowance. For low-income people, not just people on, people may call it mother's allowance. It went to mothers for their children. This allowance was not enough for families that were really low income and families on social assistance. So they gave a supplement of $100 a month per child for low income families. The national child benefit that went to all families as a tax return was supplemented for low-income families by the National Child Benefit Supplement. And that was $100 a month at around the beginning of the 2000. And it was being increased each year. However, the provinces generally, except for Manitoba and Newfoundland, were clawing this back. They said, if you're on social assistance, we know that you're getting $100 a month from the federal government, so we're taking $100 a month off your check. And gradually, a lot of fuss was being made. Actually, it started in 1998, this National Child Benefit Supplement. And at the time the Liberals came in, they decided to let any increases to this supplement go through. And they said they would gradually stop clawing it back.
Okay, can we clarify which government is giving it and which government level is pulling it back, clawing it back?
The federal government gives the supplement, and most provincial governments have been clawing it back from people on social assistance. However, the Liberals promised when they came in that they would stop doing this. And in 2008, they said they would let people keep their federal tax. They would begin to give them an Ontario child benefit, but they also cut back a large amount from their checks. So that last year, everybody got $50 a month, working poor and people on social assistance. But the people on social assistance had some of that cut back. A woman with a child 13 and over had about $245 of her Ontario child benefit taken back. Because they stopped giving, the provinces stopped giving the back to school and the winter clothing allowance. Last year it was just those two allowances, but it meant that if I'm on social assistance, instead of getting $50 a month, I was getting about $30 a month.
Okay, Lynn, you want to add to this, your point of view?
In 2008, the Ontario government decided to take the children off social assistance and instead supplement the national child benefit, but with an Ontario child benefit. And it was supposed to be $50 a child per month, $600 a year. Unfortunately, at the same time, they took back the winter clothing allowance and the back-to-school allowance, which were, depending on the age of the child, around $245, I think, for a 13-year-old. So in other words, people on social assistance got less than people who were just working poor or, you know,
everybody was getting this. It's all across the board.
Except that Ontario took off the winter clothing allowance and back to school. This year, when they were supposed to increase this child tax benefit, the Ontario child benefit, every year, and they did increase it to $42 this year to every child. But those who are on social assistance, the ones on Ontario Works and Ontario Disability, their social assistance checks were in turn reduced by almost the same amount. For instance, a mother with a 13-year-old child only received a dollar more a month. Some other people with younger children got up to $17 more a month instead of the $42 that everybody else got.
So where was the reduction taken from?
Their social assistance checks.
And so there's two areas on the check. There's basic shelter and then there's needs. So where was it taken from?
Off the basic needs.
Basic needs.
The really galling thing is that the Minister of Community Social Services, Madeleine Meyer, does not acknowledge that this has happened. When she was questioned in October in the legislature by an NDP, Michael Prue, she claimed that he was questioning her about the rates of social assistance being low. She said, well, we've just given them $1,100 a year per child, and so they're much better off than they were. But when you calculate the amount they took off for the back-to-school and winter clothing, plus the amount they took off for the basic needs this year, in fact, they lost about $737 a person with a child 13 and over. So they are not getting $1,100. They're getting $1,100 minus $737.
So they're getting whatever, $300 and some odd. Is this a government that just doesn't get it? Or because we had Deb Matthews going around interviewing people and saying the system is broken. I remember that distinctly.
Yes. And they're supposed to now be doing another review, whereas Deb Matthews' review, most anti-poverty activists think, was excellent. She said the rates were far too low. She was given the job of looking at employment programs within OW and ODSP, and she made it much broader. And she said that as long as the rates of social assistance are so low, people have to spend all their time surviving and they can't even begin to look for work. She also talked about the attitudes that she said came right down from the top, from the premier on down to the people administering social assistance. There was a negative attitude toward recipients and that it was demoralizing. One of the really bad things about our system that was set up by Mike Harris is that when people have to bring in regularly rent receipts, bank statements, and other kinds of documentation, and very often it gets lost. Lynn and I are on a committee with staff from OW and ODSP, and they admit that they don't do a very good job of keeping track of the documentation. And then the Mike Harris machine was set up that if a piece of documentation is missing, the computer automatically prints out a letter telling the person that their benefits are being suspended. And instead of getting their check that month, they get this nasty letter. And it just throws them into a tizzy. And
how much notice do they get when they get this letter?
Can I speak to that just for a second? We asked about that, and we found out that they need to get the information in between the 9th and the 26th of the month. They're given that much time, 2 weeks, to get their information in. If they don't have the information in by the 26th, then the letter is sent out. Unfortunately, that's exactly the same time that they're expecting their check to go into the bank. And so they get this letter instead. They notice that their money hasn't gone into the bank. They get this letter saying they're suspended, and they have to then scramble to get all the documents or whatever is needed. And they possibly didn't even know what documents were missing, because some of the forms that come out saying we need this, we need that, it's nothing is checked off. Nothing is indicated to what they do need. Some people don't have phones. Some people don't have a mailbox, so they have to go and pick things up. Things are delayed. Meanwhile, their checks are bouncing. They're in danger of losing their home because their automatic checks come out of the bank automatically, and they can't pay their rent. It's just a horrible system that these letters get printed out.
So nothing's improved in 20 years. It's gotten far worse. We have far more people unemployed. I wonder where these people go.
It's no wonder that people are so stressed out, so turning to, you know, drugs or alcohol or you know, other forms of income supplement that they don't tell the government about. People don't. This is a report that just came out in the paper the other day about overpayments. This article in the paper last week about the overpayments. Sometimes when you're asked to send in documents and you're late getting them in, you get more money than you think you're going to get. So for instance, if you have a pay stub that comes late or doesn't come at all, you have to scramble to get your employer to give you something that shows you've worked. So you get a little bit more money than you were supposed to get. So that results in an overpayment. And the Social Services Ontario Works in ODSP, they ask you to pay back 1% of that overpayment every month. They don't expect any more. And since you need the money so much, usually you go along with that. You don't say, that's fine, great. So I owe you $100, I'm only paying $10 back. So you have a $90 overpayment that is eventually eliminated after 10 months. So some of these overpayments, it's not as if people aren't paying them back. It's just that the government expects you only to pay 1% back. And since you're so short of money, you go along with that. That's fine. So it's not as if the overpayments are outstanding and not being paid off. They are being paid off, but in small amounts every month.
So what creates the problem there? They get cut off someplace?
Well, it's just that the perception that people are cheating is out there because of this statement that came out in the paper, that there's just huge overpayment. And it sounds as if people have been ripping off the government and lying about things, when really it's just paperwork that has gone wrong. And eventually, I mean, of course, some people, you know, are desperate for money to feed their children and to keep a home.
Okay, do you feel that report in the paper gave the wrong impression?
I definitely gave the wrong impression, because it looks like everybody on welfare will say is liars and cheaters, which is going back to the old perception of people that are just lazy, lying drug addicts.
Okay, so did anybody contest the paper to say, look, after all these years and decades of work of trying to stop the definition of deserving poor and undeserving poor, has anybody challenged that?
I don't
that?
Think too much came up about a challenge for that that I heard.
Well, it was the Auditor General's report that brought this forward, and Madeline Meyer got on the radio and said that there had been very little change to the balance of overpayments since their government took over. When they took over, it was already a very high level. So it's probably been there for years. She said, I think it was $1 billion in overpayments across Ontario, and that it was just about that when their government took over. So I think it's something a bit from them. So it may have been building up over 30 years. They didn't say that. One of the things that really bothers me about the documentation that people have to provide is that it costs them money. And on the amount of money they get, you can imagine that every little bit is makes it very difficult. And I once had a student who was working in a bank part-time, and she told me that the staff at the bank have a negative attitude toward social assistance recipients and that they will charge them for a bank statement the maximum, whereas somebody they like that comes in and they know they won't charge them anything. So there's a hardship even in that area.
That's illegal. That should be reported.
Yeah.
Are people still living in fear like they were before?
I think so, because when we discovered this recent clawback that of the basic needs allowance, it was only because one of our members told us. When Lynn and I brought it up at the September meeting of the OWODSP Operations Committee, the staff there were asked, well, have you been hearing from other people about what's this cutback they've had? And they claim they got no calls about it. And I think part of it is people are so afraid they're going to be cut off with these letters they get seemingly at random that they're afraid to say anything. So when they lost this money, they just took the blow and sort of put their heads down.
So it's actually enticing people to become maybe an alcoholic or something just to escape this trauma they're living in.
Well, right. The stress that people live under is just horrible. We had a forum last May with the campaign and some health professionals and teachers, and it was very much evident that the stress that people live under is so debilitating. It causes all kinds of health problems, causes heart problems, diabetes, so many mental problems, health, you know, emotional problems. I believe that ODSP staff told us that 50% now of their caseload is because of mental health problems. It's just the stress that people have to live under. If it was eliminated, suppose that people had a living income and they could just afford a healthy diet, a safe place to live, and enough clothes and resources to have their children not only educated but enjoy the privileges that their some of the recreational facilities and some of the, you know, dancing lessons, things like that. People, we heard from Bill Strickland, who's got a really good program in Pittsburgh, and he said the most important thing that helped improve their neighborhoods was having the children exposed to the arts, and it made a difference in their educational outcome, not because they were taught anything in these arts programs, just because it made them feel better about themselves and empowered them. It made them feel that they were human and that they had a future. These kinds of things are not available to poor people, even in Hamilton. And the kinds of things that they need to improve by a living wage, they could, you know, get the first level of Maslow's pyramid. They could survive. And then they could start looking at finding ways to get work, finding ways to improve their lives. People can't look for work if they have no bus fare, no clothes to wear, no way to improve their appearance, to buy, you know, suitable clothing for their job, things like that. Sally, you wanted to say something?
I wanted to say something about transit. You mentioned bus fares. The city has recently raised the bus fares probably the most pressing was a voice of the two teachers that came from St. Thomas More Secondary School. They talked about having to provide bus tickets for their students and about a family who had, they had a pass for only enough for one child. So they gave it to one child one day and one child the next day. These teachers said they were turning into social workers because of the needs in the families.
So the adult bus pass is now going to be $86 instead of $79, and the children's is going up to $71 from $63. A high school student has to pay $71 a month to get to school now because they've eliminated so many high schools that almost all of them have to take the bus to school. I want to bring the topic back. I started talking about the forum that we had in May for the campaign. The teachers from Sir Thomas More also spoke to us about the children that they have to help this year with a food bank, or for the first time they had to institute a food bank in their school. The teachers actually have to feed children every day. They give money out of their own pocket to help these children because they don't have enough to eat. One child had mercury poisoning because the only food they could get from the food bank, well, the most common food at the food bank is tuna. You're not supposed to have more than one can of tuna a week if you're a child because of the mercury. And if that's the only thing you get to eat because that's the most that they have at the food bank, then that's a problem for you.
It's every high school, right?
It's every high school now. I think even Westdale has a food pantry or cupboard for clothes and food.
I do want to emphasize the fact that it's children that feel the brunt of all of this, whether mom's the one getting cut off or being told what to do. It's the kids, and you know from the work you do what the kids go through.
Yes, also at that forum, Dr. Diana Ahmed from the North Hamilton Community Health Clinic said that if she could ask one question of a person to find out their health prospects for their life, she would ask for their socioeconomic status. If they were poor, then they had a poor outlook for their whole life system.
And so poverty is definitely an independent risk factor. In fact, it's the most important risk factor for predicting someone's health. So if I were just to pick somebody out of the audience or pick somebody out of Hamilton, pick somebody out of Canada and say, you know, how is this person's health going to be? And I could only ask them one question. I would ask them, what's your socioeconomic status? What kind of financial situation are you in? And I can make a pretty good prediction of what their health status is going to be, and that's true at any age. And children, I know we're going to be talking about children in poverty, but what's especially unique and sad about children living in poverty is that poverty scars them for life. But what we also know is that if those kids are lucky, they manage to get out of poverty, they manage to reach middle class, later on in their years, those effects of poverty still will affect their health later on. So even when they're adults living their middle class existence, if they grew up poor, their health is going to be as bad as people who are still living in poverty.
You are listening to The Other Side of the News on 93.3 CFMU FM.
Being poor as a child lasts all your life. It doesn't change. It causes changes to your brain, changes to your body that are permanent, and they never change after that.
Which would probably explain why we have more people on the system. Sally?
Yes, my background is in child welfare, and one of the things that was shown by research is that in the Ontario's Children's Aid Societies, 80% of the children are there from families on social assistance, who are the lowest income people we have. And you can make the connection that it's often reasons associated with poverty that have brought them into a children's aid society. And children have been interviewed about their experiences in foster care and have said that they wish that their families could have been given the money that it's costing to keep them in foster care, and they could have stayed at home. There have been a few projects over the years, and there was a good one in Hamilton for a long time, where they did put the money into having support for families in their own home. But mostly we fall back on taking the children out. And they don't forget about their families when they're taken out. We don't do a very good job of keeping them in touch with their families because often the foster parents are told negative things about the families, partly to, I think, recruit foster parents, that we need somebody to take over for these poor children. But in fact, the children themselves continue to worry about their parents and feel guilty about the fact that they're living somewhere else.
It's quite a tragic event, because the money that's spent for a foster, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. The money that's spent for a child to be in a foster home and going through all this emotional upheaval, and they change their schools, they change all their friends, their whole world is suddenly turned upside down and they're expected to cope and behave normally. And yet it would be better spent to give that money to the actual parents. I mean, if the reason the children are being taken out is financial, then we've got something terribly wrong with our system.
Terribly wrong.
Yeah. We heard about Lynn's daughter at the campaign and what happened when she had to move into subsidized housing.
My daughter always felt that, you know, everyone feels that if you live on the mountain, you have a better life up there. You have a better class of people for your children to associate with. So she found a place that was $900 a month, including heat and hydro. So that was really good. It was three bedrooms. Unfortunately, her Ontario Works check, even with her and the three children, was only $840 a month. But she had the National Child Benefit to fall back on as well. So that's what she did. She moved into this place. It was $900 a month. And the food and clothing and everything that they lived on came out of their child tax benefit, which is approximately at that time around between $500 and $600 a month, I think it was, for the three children. So unfortunately, Ontario Works noticed that her rent check was $900. So every month she would get this cutoff letter saying, wait a minute, you must be lying to us. You're paying $900 a month and your check is only $840. So her rent check would bounce. She got taken to the rent tribunal, which was $150 that she had to pay for the landlord because her rent was late. And he had an obligation to his employers that he had to take her to the rent tribunal. So eventually, after struggling for over a year, almost 2 years, trying to keep her kids in the mountain schools, she became homeless. She couldn't keep up anymore. The landlord evicted her, and they became homeless for 3 months until they got, because they were homeless and the children were separated from them, from the parent, they finally got a subsidized home down on Samford, 21 Samford North. It's a wonderful building in that there's a lot of children and families who are in the same situation. They are very welcoming to each other. It's like a little village. It's a wonderful atmosphere for the children to have all their friends in one place. They go in the halls. They talk to each other. It's like a little village. Everybody takes care of the kids. Unfortunately, they also have poor security for the building. So at night, drug dealers can go into the halls. They find needles. They find condoms in the stairwells. People defecate in the elevators, and the walls are have graffiti put on them. And you know, for that, my littlest granddaughter once said she watched a swimming thing on the Olympics, and the swimmers had earplugs. She said, I wish I could have some earplugs so I could sleep at night. I said, what do you mean? Why do you need earplugs? She said, all the people yelling all the time. I can't get any sleep. And I just, you know, my daughter tried so hard to give them a better life, and now they're living in this place. And it's really difficult for me to see that.
Is that city-owned subsidized housing?
No, it's Kiwanis.
Is there anything the Kiwanis can do about it, bring it to their attention, make it public? Well, we're making it public now, but is there anything else that we can do about that situation?
You know, a better security at the doors would be great. Occasionally, the people in there are stressed out. Let's face it, they are all on social assistance. They're stressed out. They don't always have the best choices in their lives. Occasionally they get rowdy. There have been shootings and knives, and I think there's drugs going on, you know, in the building as well. The children think everything is wonderful because they don't see that. They don't see their parents as bad or good. They just see parents. And unfortunately, some of the bad things that happen do affect the children, though. My grandchildren have had sirens, you know, quite often, at least once a week, they have police coming into the building for this or that. And they have, you know, blood in the halls, and their friends are getting knifed.
That would that explain the violence in the high schools that I've been hearing about?
It may. I mean, these children are stressed to the max. They can't afford the things that they see on TV. They can't afford all the wonderful things that even their neighbors two or three streets away are enjoying. So, you know, people get they get so frustrated, and so the injustice of not being able to live in a free society, to have everything shown to you on TV that, you know, you should be having, that everybody else enjoys, and then you can't have it because your parents can't get a job.
Which would explain why kids get angry and turn to drugs and gangs, because they can get money.
Right.
Another thing that happens with children coming from poor families is they often get treated differently at school. They often don't look very good. Their clothes may not be always clean because they don't have that many clothes. And there's a tendency for a teacher to look at a child and feel kind of hopeless about a child who looks like they're not being well fed and well looked after. Those teachers at St. Thomas More were actually saints themselves, I would say, in that they were reaching out to the children that had been marginalized. But it gives you a very bad start in school. One study showed that the children who seem to not have much of an educational background in coming into kindergarten and were poorly dressed tended to get seated at the back of the room. And the children that looked like they had a lot more potential were put at the front of the room. And the sociologists who looked at that found that 3 years later, they went into the same group of children, those that were still there, and found the same children had been sort of pushed to the back. They'd never been able to recover from that initial impression that was really based on how they looked and what their address was.
Why would teachers do that?
I'm not sure. It may have been a stressed-out group of teachers. It was actually in the U.S. this happened, but one of my colleagues at McMaster did a study of school dropouts in Toronto, and she was particularly looking at racism because among African-Canadian families, there is a much higher dropout rate. And one of the themes she found in her interviews with students was that the teachers, they felt, looked down on them. I was shocked. I was thinking that the racism would be the other students pushing them aside, because I've seen that happen at McMaster. But in fact, they felt the teachers were not interested in them and really didn't want them there.
Lynn, I'm going to ask you if you can just explain that a little bit more about the food banks. And after that, I want to get into homelessness, because it's been really cold. We've gotten a couple of cold alerts, but we have no place for women and children in Hamilton. I made some phone calls, and I was very surprised to find out how little there is as a place to get off the street.
It's very evident to me. My daughter came to me the other day and said, do you have $20 I could borrow so I could take a taxi home from the food bank, because I'm going to go there and get some food? And so I said, sure, and I gave it to her. And then she phoned me later and she said, oh, the food bank's closed because of the Christmas hampers. I said, oh, I thought that's what you were going to get, was your Christmas hamper. And she said, no, we just needed some food. I said, well, then, you know, I helped her out, because she was too proud, I guess, to ask for money for food. She didn't mind asking for taxi fare to go get food, but, you know, to get it home. She thought she was getting some from the food bank. And the kind of food that they have at the food bank, we haven't touched on that, but it's not very healthy. Everybody knows that, I think. You get canned food, you get pasta, you get bread, and you get tuna. That's about it. And it's not a healthy diet. The kids are really suffering because of that. And one of the things besides the food banks that is bad is the out-of-the-cold program that you spoke about. The Out of the Cold program is really great. The churches are wonderful that they provide this. Unfortunately, they've had to cut back on the sleepover part of their Out of the Cold program this year. Apparently, the men's shelters are not as full as they could be. And since they get money from the city for each person who sleeps there, they've decided to try to force men to sleep in the shelters instead of going to the Out of the Cold programs. Unfortunately, the women's shelters are full. They're packed. And a lot of the people who went to the Out of the Cold sleepovers were women. It wasn't so much the men. And now that they've stopped the Out of the Cold sleepover program, it's the women who will be out on the street. Well, actually, what happened was the city actually gave more money to the shelters for men. And so now they want to make sure that that money is recouped by getting the beds full, you see. Unfortunately, it's not the men who need the shelters. It's the women and children who need the shelters.
So please explain to me what sense that makes.
It doesn't make any sense.
And kids.
And kids,
there's
yes.
nothing for kids.
No, there's nothing for kids at all for a sleepover. I don't know, I'm sorry, what the Living Rock provides for their youth. I think they do have something. I'm not sure if it's a sleepover or not. But they're a very wonderful program for the youth. But the little children and mothers who are in shelters that are full, we tried to get shelter for a family who had come in. They were newcomers. And there wasn't any shelter. We called all the way down to Caledonia, all the way over to Scarborough. We checked the whole of Southern Ontario. There was no shelters available for this family.
No place to get them off
because it was a father and his children. It wasn't a mother and his children.
Oh, my God.
So what they had to do was split the children up and from the father and let, you know, just strangers, really, the kindness of strangers to take them in. But they had to split the family up to do that. As a practical person, I can see, well, you know, the shelters are not very full for the men. Take one shelter, make it into a woman's shelter, make the men go to the other shelters. I mean, what's the big problem? I don't see any.
Just where I live alone, I can count within two blocks of where I live, I can count at least half a dozen empty buildings. Empty. Well, the Good Shepherd builds a brand new building, which is going to be great, but we got to wait for that to come along. But the other part of the Good Shepherd's development is they took a small inner urban park and destroyed the trees, which is not a good idea. You're not helping society or the people you're trying to help by doing that. Typical developers, show a plan to the community and they say this is how it's going to be and then it turns out to be something totally different. Money is wasted by that. I mean, such a waste. And yet there's so many buildings sitting empty, like the federal building. That could be housing people, the people you're talking about. I just don't understand what has to be done to make that change.
One of the main reasons people are homeless is because they don't have enough money to pay for shelter. And we are hoping that the social assistance review, which is now about to start in Ontario, is going to do something about the rates of social assistance, which have stayed so abysmally low. It's otherwise going to keep happening that people will lose their homes because they can't afford them. Lynn mentioned that the shelter portion of her daughter's payments is about the same as she gets from Ontario Works, and she has to make up the rest from money that came down from the federal government or the Ontario Child Benefit. But shelter is really a huge issue. Because the amounts are so low for social assistance. There's a campaign right now to put $100 healthy food supplement into the amount of social assistance a single person gets. And we've gone to politicians, MPPs, and asked them to do the math to look at how somebody who gets now $585 a month can get themselves an apartment, which the average one is about $500 a month. So they've got $85 left to pay for everything else. The only way we're going to get social assistance levels raised is through politicians. And our group went to see Ted McMeekin some time ago about the clawback and how it's affected people. And one of his comments was, well, we couldn't afford to give this Ontario Child Benefit increase without taking something back from people in social assistance. Our budget is way over, as we all know. They're in big deficit. And so we couldn't afford it. And our argument is that you should not be taking it from the people who are already at the bottom of the economic ladder.
And let's point out that they get an automatic raise every year.
Well, I remember one year the Liberals gave themselves a 25% raise in their salaries, and they gave a 2% raise to people on social assistance. And over all the years they've been in, since 2003, they've only given 11% to people on social assistance in comparison with that 25%. So we need more people to go to their MPPs and question the way we're treating families at the bottom.
Okay, so find your MPP. And I know they take, well, homeowners, they take the social assistance amount right off your residential tax. It's right there on your tax bill. If that makes you mad, then you should go to your MPP and your MP and say, look, you know, especially your local government, and say, if I'm paying this much money, why are there so many people? I mean, they shouldn't have to pay that much money. It should be uploaded in the first place.
Right.
Harris also did that. Lynn, you want to close off with anything?
People don't realize how much it makes a difference if you actually phone or email or mail a letter to your MPPs and to your local government. It makes a difference. They understand then that people are hurting. If more people would just complain about their system, they're afraid that they will be cut off their checks. They're held in hostage to their survival. They need to be able to know their rights and complain about it. Human Rights Code that Canada signed says that every person's shall be guaranteed a life that will be prosperous and that will continue to become more prosperous, not go downhill. And since Canada is a signatory for that, it hasn't happened. And the UN, every time they have a review, Canada is chastised for not living up to their signatory on the Human Rights Code. So let your MPs know that this is wrong. Let your city officials know that this is wrong. It will make a difference.
Okay. I want to thank both of you for coming in today and letting people know what it's really like out there in the street. We've had Professor Sally Palmer come in and Lynn Aquin from the Campaign for Adequate Welfare and Disability Benefits. If you want to get involved with them, they have a great meeting. It's a great group. Lynn, when do they meet?
The second and fourth Wednesdays at 1 o'clock at First Pilgrim United Church, 200 Main Street East.
Okay. At the beginning of the show, I talked to you about Bill Mahoney. That's spelled M-A-H-O-N-E-Y. If you go to YouTube and type in that name in Hamilton, you're going to find his poem about poverty. I'm going to be playing that in a second. I also wanted to give you some announcements. If you still want to give food, clothing, or gifts and that for Christmas, it's not too late. This show that airs on the 15th, you can drop your things off at 210 Napier Street. I advise you to call the Christmas Gifts number first and find out what they need. That number is 528-8073. Ask for Carolyn. The things that I was told they need in the way of food is rice, canned fruit, dried lentils, dried beans, tea, coffee, condiments, stuffing mix, fresh apples, pears, turnips, and feminine supplies, diapers, things you don't normally think about. If you call that number, ask for Carolyn. She'll tell you what they need. Things change all the time. If you're listening to the show airing on December the 22nd, it's too late for 210 Napier, but you can still take things down to the Wesley Mission, which is on Ferguson Street. And remember, just because it's Christmas and you feel a little like giving and sharing, these people live in poverty without food and clothing all year long. As you've heard during the show, we've emphasized what life in dire poverty is like here in Canada. You can be helping all year. It's not just food, and you heard the food that they get at the food banks. Mix it up a little, people, if you can. go to the farmer's market. They have bins there now. Karen Bernstein is one of these people in the community that's made sure that the Ottawa Farmer's Market has a bin for dropping off fresh fruit. It's a great idea. And also, before we finish the show, I want you to hear some closing remarks from those three teachers that gave that testimony in the forum for the CAWDB last May.
I have been a Catholic teacher in Hamilton for 13 years. I was an English teacher, a special education teacher, and I'm currently a student success teacher along with Rose and Jessica. I've been a lot of things to a lot of students. I've been a friend, I've been a mom, I've been a mentor, I've been even an adversary at times. But what I don't understand is, when did I become a social safety net for some of my students? My students are poor, so they're hungry. My students are worried about their family's finances, so they're stressed. My students are working all kinds of hours to help their parents pay bills, so they're tired all the time. And where does that put me in all of this? Well, I'll tell you. Last week, a student approached me and told me that she didn't have any food in her house. So what did I do? I gave her $60 out of my wallet. Last month, one of my students was having suicidal thoughts. She had no family doctor. She didn't have ties to any social services in the community. So Jessica and I, we put her in the car. We brought her down to my family doctor. She applied to become a patient. We helped her with the paperwork. Then we brought her back to the actual appointment that she got. And we sat there and we held her hand while she spilled her guts to the nurse practitioner and then again to the doctor. In April, another colleague helped a student who couldn't afford to fill a prescription for antidepressants. This colleague went to the pharmacy herself. She dropped off the prescription. She paid for it out of her own pocket, and she made sure that she put these meds directly into the student's hands. And in May, she did it again, because again, that poor kid couldn't afford it. So please, if you extrapolate one thing from what I'm telling you today, please understand this from us. These little side deals and these little private, discreet teacher-student exchanges, they're occurring every day. There's countless of them in classrooms, in hallways, and they're occurring in all of our schools. I just want to thank you for your time. I just want to leave you with two simple questions to which I know I would love some solid answers, and I'm sure you would. My first question is, why do we continue to stretch this band-aid and perpetuate the flaws in a system that's turned its teachers into social workers, its social workers into surrogate parents, and its parents into the powerless? And lastly, I just want to know, why aren't the politicians and power brokers of this province ashamed at the fact that its schools have to house food banks, and that these food banks are stocked by teachers themselves? And if we as teachers don't scrape and scramble and fundraise and beg to stock these shelves every month, our students simply don't eat.
Bill Mahoney, the rhyming rebel from Local 1005 in Hamilton, Ontario. This poem's titled, Eddie. Your brother's sleeping on a grate. You rush on by, can't hesitate. You say you'll never be that way, and that the poor are here to stay. I'm telling you, you better pray, because poverty's one job away. You've never been down and out, been so poor you want to shout. I just can't take it anymore, as they throw you out the door. Eddie came from the East Coast, was doing well, he used to boast. Till Stelco took his job away, he's hoping to go home someday. Jack was working on a farm, till he slipped and lost an arm. Now he's in a private house, sleeping in some damn stairwell. Bob can't read or write, for every strap he has to fight. He sleeps in the park at night, shouldn't housing be a right? Mary's trying to ease the pain of the demons she can't name. She hears echoes in her mind of things better left behind. The working class must not retreat, or we'll all be living in the street. Then each would have a tale to tell of what it's like to live in hell.
This has been The Other Side of the News, and thanks for listening.